Great. So I'm Rick Hansen. This is November 11th, 2015. Good. And I want to talk with you about what it means to be a Buddhist. What does that mean? There's actually a fairly well-known book in Buddhist circles written by a well-known Buddhist teacher called Why I'm Not a Buddhist, right? And I go back to the original meaning of the word Buddha. Why was this historical figure who did not claim any supernatural powers, basically, you know, was through his own efforts and practices that he became awakened, why was he called Buddha or Buddha? Essentially, Buddha means knowing, one who knows, the knowing. And in the knowing, utterly central, clearly central to Buddhist practice is a quality of non-clinging. As Joseph Goldstein put in his book, One Dharma, that came out maybe 10 years or so ago, he said, no schools of Buddhism tell us to cling more. Right? It's all about non-clinging, non-attachment. And so we have, therefore, fundamental to Buddhoing, right, is this quality of recollectedness, that's the essence of mindfulness, presence, sustained presence, rather than forgetfulness, lost in thought, lost in the inner mini movies, you know, that are so tempting in the inner theater of the mind, right? Sustaining a quality of presence while letting go, non-clinging, not attaching, not fighting what's unpleasant or chasing what's pleasant or clinging to what's heartfelt. Right? So right in our practice, like in the meditation we did earlier, or in any ordinary moment in life, while we are sustaining present moment awareness and while non-clinging, letting go, we are Buddhoing our way through life. You are being Buddha, you know. That's the essence of the practice in a lot of ways. And so that's why I was making the suggestions that I was making tonight in terms of meditation. How can we sustain? It's easy to sustain present moment awareness for a few seconds in a row. It's easy to sustain a quality of letting go, but in the next moment, the mind wants to hold on to something else. Wants to essentialize, thingify some sound, some sight, some thought, some emotion, some memory, and then hook onto it and do something with it or something about it. It's very natural in cognizing, in just functioning mentally. And while it's a very efficient way to keep monkeys, mice, and lizards alive in the wild, over 600 million years of evolution of the nervous system, it creates a lot of suffering. That's kind of the essence, if you will, of the Buddhist analysis or critique of the conventional mind, the conventional life, right? Thingifying, attaching hurts and harms, right? The antidote to it being the treatment, based on the diagnosis, the cure, is knowing and letting go. That's what Ajahn Chah, Jack Kornfield's primary teacher, great Thai meditation master, a million people attended his memorial service. This very humble monk in Thailand, a much smaller country than our own. You can imagine if you scaled it up, how many people would be attending memorial service in America. I have no idea, maybe 10 million, whatever the population of Thailand is. Anyway, so Ajahn Chah's summary teaching was practices about knowing. He means in a sense, not intellectually, but rather present moment awareness. Recollectedness, you know, being with while letting go. That's the essence of practice, the essence of meditation. It's as simple as that, right? Of course, while being simple, it's not so easy to sustain, is it? That's really the art, isn't it? It's very real. It's very experience close, right? It's not about believing in anything. It's not about anything magical. It's about being here, now, continually, with an internal freedom, in relationship to experience with that letting go. Wow, it's as simple and profound as that. That's Buddhoing. That's what it means to be, if you will, Buddhist. Not that it's like a special card we're trying to claim. It's just the essence of the practice. And what's really quite remarkable is that one thing that begins to appear increasingly as you stabilize this way of being, present, here, letting go, is what starts to appear increasingly in the midst of all that, remarkably, is love. In one flavor or another, compassion, warm-heartedness, a leaning toward. I had a spiritual teacher for a while, Adi Da, who had the phrase, grace leans. There's a kind of leaning, a benevolent leaning that somehow arises or appears in the middle of that, you know, letting go. Things fall apart and fall open, infused by love. And also, to be able to do this, letting go, letting go, letting go, allowing phenomenology to fragment, allowing experiences to just be insubstantial and disappear right at the edge of now. Wow, that's kind of scary and freaky, right? It sort of goes against our nature. It's like, whoa! You know, I've likened it for me experientially to, it's like you are standing there on the, you know, 20th floor, you hit the button for the elevator to come, right? And you wait a little bit, the lights go, okay, it's getting closer. There it is, the door's open. And you step in, and whoo, there's nothing underneath your feet with that letting go, and yet you somehow don't fall down. You're continually recreated by just the ongoingness of reality and experiencing. But to be able to do that is pretty spooky. And so, not just as a fruit of that practice, the increasing appearing of some kind of amazing warm-heartedness, but as a factor of that practice, the cultivation of love, kindness, a friendliness, you know, a caring, a gentleness, a leaning in, a forness, right? The cultivation of that helps us do this fundamental Buddhoing, which is as radical and full as it can be in our own moment with it. So I want to just call out those three things. Sustained presencing, non-clinging, with a warm-heartedness so it doesn't start feeling sterile and intellectualized and pedantic somehow, you know, that it has a juiciness to it. Okay? So you might reflect on where those factors are at in your own practice. Where are you at with a stability, a continuity of present moment awareness with a quality of letting go, non-clinging, releasing, right? Receiving, releasing, emphasizing releasing with a warmth, you know, a gentleness, a sweetness, whatever that quality is for you, right? Where are you at with those three things? And then about that, I have just two kind of comments and then see what you feel into about all this. You know, it's kind of like opening out while being lived by love. Opening out while being lived by love. Right? You have a feeling for that, right? Okay. One comment or suggestion about sustaining that present moment awareness, I'm struck more and more by the ways in which one of the two, I think, primary neurological evolutions over the last several million years, the two are adaptation to group living and the development of the simulator based in these midline cortical networks, mainly in the back, the default mode, so-called, where we just kind of trip out into mini-movies, right? There you are, breath, 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 shopping list, what's for dinner tonight, should I or should I not have that extra cookie that I know I've secreted, and no, breath, you come back, right? So the simulator, like chimpanzees don't have a simulator. Our nearest relative can't just sort of go into reverie or imagine different possible futures, right? And there's a great evolutionary benefit to having a simulator. But one, we live in a culture with all of its media that's an incredible stimulation and therefore strengthening of the neural basis of the simulator. And it's really easy to get lost internally with our own inner media. And second, it's also so easy to get caught up in our own inner simulator with a lot of negative preoccupations. On average, studies show in which people are routinely beeped with their smartphone that they're lost in the simulator about 50% of the time. Basically distracted, just spun out, not presently engaged, either just present as presence or present while actually doing something productive of one kind or another, including brushing your daughter's hair. Okay, 50% of the time, the average person is gone. You know, Gurdjieff called it sleepwalking through life. Okay, and one of the more reliable findings about contrasting long-term meditators with matched people who don't meditate is the fact that long-term meditators tend to spend much, much less time in the simulator. They're not in the default mode. It's not their default anymore. They start defaulting to sustained present moment awareness rather than defaulting to reveries of one kind or another. And second, on the whole, when you ask people, okay, what was the content of that little last little moment when you were gone, right? Those little mini movies, they're usually negative. It's a worry, a preoccupation, what's that pain? Should I see a doctor? What could it mean? I just haven't had lunch, but what if it's more serious than that? Or a lot of interpersonal preoccupations tend to be, they are rarely, right? It would be so luscious if our mini movies were, oh wow, everyone loves me. It's great. My grandchildren hug me. Wow, what a sweet, long, sustained hug that was. You know, it's not that usually, is it? It's usually how we feel wronged, or we're kind of caught up in some tension, or we're trying to figure something out, or how should I approach that, or how could I get more people there? Or there's just sort of a background atmosphere or in the, you know, inner climate system of the mind that has a negative tinge to it of anxiety or apprehensiveness or uneasiness or irritability or melancholy, right? And again, there are too, a lot of research has shown that the more time people spend in the simulator, in rumination of one kind or another, the more that's a typically, on average, a negative factor for mental health. So operationally, one of the fundamental things we do in our contemplative training and practice is to stimulate the neural circuitry, if you will, of, you know, non-simulatorness, of staying out of the mini-movies. And a lot of what we do when we meditate is to become more and more skillful is starting to notice when we're about to get drawn into the mini-movie, right? And prevent that, or come out of it faster, or have the little mini-movie be just a small part of the total field of awareness with still a lot of sustained present moment awareness. Does that make kind of sense? It's an interesting way to think about it. Kind of functionally, operationally, a lot of what we're doing is try to train in being less captured by the mini-movies, less captured by the simulator. And there are a couple things that really help. One is to go out to the experience of things as a whole, because that activates networks on the sides of the brain that pull us out of this middle area, so getting a sense of the body as a whole, or the whole body of breathing. The Buddha used that phrase in terms of mindfulness of breathing. Or you could even go out to a sense of just experience as a whole or mind as a whole, or a sense of the physical space as a whole. Anything that takes you out to gestalt awareness, things as a whole, are going to tend to pull you out of the midline and help you sit more on the sides of the brain, especially the right side, things as a whole. Okay? and also being a little more deliberate, like a task focusing in a healthy sense helps keep us out of this default mode, simulator, rumination mode. And the task can be the interesting process of sustaining global present moment awareness. Right? Or the task can be walking mindfully. Right? Or the task could be doing anything while sustaining that present moment awareness. That can help reduce the simulator. Right? Got it? Like, kind of bottom line it, you know, more time in the simulator, bad. Right? Kind of simple. Okay, so that's one thing. And watch the simulator. Watch what draws you into the simulator. Watch how you feel, how you fuel those little mini movies. Right? Okay. The second thing I just want to offer and then see what you think about all this stuff about Buddhoing is to be aware of what we cling to. Right? What is it that we attach to? We hook on. And to kind of help us here, the Buddha pointed out that there are at least four main types of things we cling to in ways that are problematic. Okay? One thing we tend to cling to, he called sense pleasures. We tend to fight pain or hook to pleasure. And I would add myself, because I think we're so enormously social as a species, we tend to really cling to what's heartfelt. Okay. So you might observe, to what extent do you get, you know, caught up in fighting with what's painful or unpleasant, or caught up in grabbing on to or attaching to what could feel pleasurable or, you know, socially rewarding, let's say. It's okay to enjoy these pleasures. It's okay to enjoy social rewards. It's natural to pull our hand away from what's painful. But you can start to feel there's a tipping into getting caught up in it, struggling with it, attaching to it, rather than this feeling of letting go, knowing what it feels like to let go. What's it feel like to exhale? You know, what's it feel like to just go, okay? You know, what's that feel like? And then applying that around sense pleasure, pleasant, unpleasant, heartfelt, and neutral. The second category of attachment he talked about was to view, right? And when you're paid to have right view, like I am, it's especially important to be very careful about getting attached to view. Most of us in this room, in many ways, are seeking to, you know things and understand things, or many of us are actually make a living being right, you know, having the good idea, the right plan, the best recommendation, the way to do it, what to do about this, what to do about that. And there's a place for that, but the more that that's your living, and the more trained in you are in that, and the more the world, you know, beats a path to your door because you're good at that, aha, the more important it is to be particularly careful about getting attached to our opinions and our views about things. One of the things that most caused me to suffer during the 3.5 or so months I was very involved with my father's medical issues were the subtleties of getting attached to my view about how it was or how it ought to be or how it was going to be or how it had been or what other people were like or what their true intentions were. Attachment to view. Okay, so you might want to check that out for yourself. Third main category, the Buddha called it rites and rituals. We might update it in terms of routines or behavioral patterns or habits. You know, we tend to get attached to our habits, right? And you might observe that in yourself as well. Like, does the day have to proceed according to this schedule? I had a client who could not tolerate a single dry grain of rice in her sink after she had to clean the kitchen all the time. It had to be perfect all the time. That's an attachment to a rite or a ritual, a habit. And then last, of course, is the attachment to self. So interesting. There we are. You can just feel this like perspective coming forward or my this or that, or I'm identified with this or that, or how, you know, how could you see me that way? I was just in a meeting with someone earlier who, you know, multiple times said, basically described me as being X or Y or Z, right? And I mean, that's an interesting move in a meeting with a new person to start telling them how they are, right? Like, there's some risks with that. But second, flip it around for me, like I was like, what do you mean I'm like that? You know, or who are you to tell me I'm like that? You don't even know me. Or, you know, wow, that's a real power move to that you're the one who gets to comment about me. Like, of course, I'm getting then all activated about, hey, do you think you can push me around here? You know, just because you have 20 years on me or something like that. Right? We can get really caught up in selfing, really attached to that. Okay, so just think about that for yourself as a kind of roadmap around attaching. Anyway, just to sum it up, to bring it back again, three things, just in our own practice. And for me, it actually means something that I think they were absolutely at the heart of the Buddha's own practice, as best I can imagine that with, you know, modesty and respect. This fundamental process of sustained present moment awareness and extending it, sustaining it. What's the quality of continuity? What's your edge where it starts to crumble? Usually it's around 4 to 6 breaths. 1 or 2 dozen seconds, it starts to crumble, right? But with practice, with habit, we can start sustaining it longer and longer. Or it crumbles when we're talking with people. We can do it when it's quiet and we're in the woods and we're warm, right? Or something. But can we do it when things are more challenging or chaotic or busy? Okay, sustained present moment awareness under all conditions. 2, this fundamental matter of, you start to experience a kind of ecstasy in letting go. Oh my God, thank you. Let it go. Let it go. Let it go. Let it go knowing. Let go of controlling. Letting go. While opening to what's wholesome and beneficial. So letting go. And 3, that opening to warm-heartedness, to a lovingness, a kindness, a sweetness, however that is authentically real for you. I think that's what it means to be a Buddhist. That's what it means when you or I or anyone is being Buddha. Presence, releasing, love. How's that for you?
I was just gonna say that when you work and you get really, really busy, it feels like it goes super fast. So theoretically, you're not in that alternate space of, you know, thinking of daydreaming and doing all of that. So it makes you feel good because the workday is going faster, but then you're more stressed. And I guess that's because then you can't do the other 3 things while you're being crazy and getting all the work done. Doing your movie thing, but then you're still exhausted.
Yeah, that's a very cool example. I mean, if you think about it, maybe there is that sustained awareness, right? But is there letting go? And is there that sweetness, that love, if you will? Yeah, and it's like a one-legged stool, but we need the other 2 also. That's nice. And then it's to kind of check that. Okay, how can I dial up whatever might be missing? Yeah. That's great. Thank you. Yeah. Great.
So if someone were to ask me if I'm a Buddhist, the best I can say is sometimes. Periodically.
Yeah.
Not very often.
Yeah.
So, yeah. No, I just enjoyed it. It's not about a belief system at all.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it's funny. What's your edge, right? What's the growing edge for you personally? That's the reflection here I really invite you into, you know. And how could you gently, in a skillful way, open into and increasingly stabilize the next step, whatever your next step is? Oh, great.
One piece I need clarity on is one of in terms of intentional reverie, like just one thing, I actually intentionally think of gratitude, but I'm in reverie when I'm replaying things that are great to me. So when you were saying they're usually negative, I'm like, mine are actually usually positive now. Mm. So, but I am in that simulator, I think.
Yeah. Well, if I understand you right, the finding about rumination being negative from on average is about average, obviously. Yeah. And I think some people tend to be more tilted just by their temperament, one way or the other, in terms of where they go. And I do think, you know, as from the standpoint of taking in the good, there is a place for those little mini movies. But I find for myself, I guess I would say there's such a difference between a whole body kind of marinating, let's say, in gratitude.
Yeah.
Which has that quality of sustained present moment recollectedness, and it's very full, rather than just kind of spinning out into a little fantasy where, like, I'm thinking about something that was neat. It doesn't feel like the whole me is there. And it also feels that implicit in that fantasy are these two problems that are built into most of our mini movies, if you look at them structurally. One is that there's self in third person, there's the me in it, you know, that person over there that the movie's about. And then there's also embedded in it a presumption of an I, a kind of subject or perspective in the mini movie that's substantial and stable. And in both of those, you have this presumption of self as an entity, a solid brick-like thingy that's just presumed in the nature of the mini movie. If it's really interesting to watch your own mini movies, they're usually only a few seconds or so, maybe a few dozen seconds, and then boop, they pop into something else. There's a new channel, right? But watch the sense of self present in the mini movie, both as me and as I. And realize, wow, my mini movies are programming this one broadly to presume a self.
Uh-huh.
Well, that's cool. Is there a perspective of I in it as it goes? Yeah. See, I don't know. Yeah. Anyway, not to get way technical about it, but I'm kind of encouraging you. Like for me, it's striking how much time we spend in mini movies. The average is 50%. Wow. You know. So what's the nature of your mini movies? How do they happen? How do they arise? And you know, is it beneficial or not? Anyway. Yeah, there was a hand over there, yep.
Yeah, at times, I feel like I'm playing these mini-movies when I'm dreaming.
Yeah, yeah. Dreams are the epitome of the mini-movie, yeah. And there's a place for it, right? We evolved it for a place. There's learning, and maybe there could be...
Sometimes it wakes me up. It startles me. It's like there's this whole battle going on somewhere.
Yeah.
And I think it's this little mini-movie.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great. Tom, or there's a hand over there. Great, yeah.
Extend your remarks into awareness, mindfulness, relative to the list, management of the list, the things you have to do today, the things you have to do tomorrow, those mini movies, if you will, that are constantly playing, that balance, that switching in and out. How does one survive, you know, but be mindfully aware in the present?
Well, a couple things. So I think it's a great question because so many of us, again, we have to get stuff done. And also there's a satisfaction in doing things and lining it out. I think there's a place, certainly, for goal-directed activity, right? We're trying to accomplish something. But if you're interested in, if you buy the fundamental point, basically, Buddha was saying, you know, less presence of mind, more suffering. More clinging, more suffering. Less love, more suffering. So to bring it really kind of down to earth, in a sense, we're talking about, okay, how do I increase state, presence, releasing, love, and how do I, you know, states, moments, And how do I also increase over time? Trait, stable, continuous presence of mind, letting go, like an inner freedom, lived by love. Right? It's very practical, isn't it? How do I actually do that? And if you don't buy that fundamental view, it's okay, right? But let's suppose we're in that fundamental view, which is a view and value. It's our take that it's true, and the takeaway is that we value presence, letting go, and love, compassion, kindness, so forth. Okay, so then the question becomes, even around things that really catch us, like it's really easy to just kind of, oh wow, Sharon, here we are, hanging out. That's pretty easy to do, but caught up in emails, to-do lists, or arguing with somebody, or trying to persuade someone to something, or that's trickier, right? So then right there, that's where it gets really useful, where it's hard for us to sustain this quality of present moment, you know, recollectedness, releasing, and, you know, a fundamental kindness toward ourselves, the task, and other people, you know? And so for myself, one thing that helped me was I started observing how much I was thingifying tasks. You know, like this result was this thing. It was a brick-like entity. And what worked for me was an internal comment, tasks are empty. Empty in the technical sense. They exist, but they're foamy, they're insubstantial, they're made up of many parts, they're transient, they're dynamic, right? That right there was really helpful to me, you know. Another one is wants are empty. You know, we want these things. The nature of wanting is it feels like a thing. The chest tightens, the drive gets into it. It's, you know. And, okay, there's a place for that to some extent, but it's quite powerful to step back and look at that craving for a cigarette or a drink or to prove your point. That's a lot where wants really show up, right, socially. And to go, wow, can I step back from that experience and recognize that that experience of wanting, drive, insistence, gotta, right, should, like, wow, as an experience, it's sort of insubstantial and doesn't need to claim me and control me. It's really about just kind of recognizing those aspects in our actual experience. Not philosophically, but going, well, directly, wow. Anyway, so those two things really help me. Tasks are empty, wants are empty. And then what also helps is a kind of inner buffer. I think so much about practice is installing shock absorbers, you know, where it's like, okay, there is that task, and I can feel that inner insistence, like I'm glued to the task. I got to get it done. I got to finish these dishes. I got to get that email out the door. I got to make this point somehow, whatever. And then instead to step back from it and go, you know, wait a second, can I have some air around this? I think about the saying that the physician's great resources are light and air. The great healing power of light and air. We bring light to our own mind and we kind of air it out. Make sense? Can you feel that? It's a kind of a lightness, you step backness. If you're caught in the moment, you can't do it. That's where that sustained present moment awareness can really help. Also, I think it can so help to feel loved already. You know, it's so hard for us to feel loved already, loved enough already. But as we feel more and more loved enough already and loving enough already, even if they don't get it, right? To feel that you are loving even if they don't get it. To know you are loving even if they don't get it. That can also help us cling less.
Maybe it's not for tonight, maybe it's for later, but it would be nice to hear your comments at some point about where positive visualization fits in the Buddhist framework. You've been talking about the mini movies, and yeah. I was reading a Tony Robbins book years ago and about having dominion over that movie and being able to remake that movie, rewind it, and then remake it.
Yeah.
And so, I, you know, at some point, or if you have any comment now about you know, holding the highest and best good, having healthy aspirations.
Yeah.
After the rod effect, right?
After what?
After the rod effect. We all live in the rod effect. Get it done, get it done. And nobody feels happy at, you know, the end of the day when, you know, I mean, honestly, it's hard to sustain that. But I think if you think about God at the beginning of the day, maybe you can. But day after day, that's why everybody gets angry and cranky.
Right. Right. Yeah, in a way, my own experience of being interested in, you know, suffering less, starting really when I was quite young, because I was suffering a lot, and being exposed to a lot of traditions and a lot of teachings, you know, clinical psychology, human potential, you know, a pretty good involvement with several of the major spiritual traditions in the world, it can start feeling really complicated, you know, and kind of heady and airy. And maybe it's because I'm experiencing cognitive decline as I age, but I get more and more interested in what's the simple heart of the matter now, you know, and what's your practice now, and how's that working for you, and what supports it, and what gets in the way of it. Really, today, right here, right now, right? And so, to Tom's point, in a lot of ways, I think the Buddha really said this. I was talking with someone earlier about just the essence of Christianity. It seemed really quite similar. And it's really supported by modern neuroscience. It's basically, what are we resting attention on? What's the central preoccupation or thing that's happening in our experience? And since neurons that fire together wire together, or as the traditional saying have it, your mind takes its shape from what it repeatedly rests upon, right? And so for me, it's absolutely central, and I think that's really present in our best guess as to the core teachings of the Buddha, you know, the Pali Canon, this collection of teachings. That was written down several centuries after he died, that it really is a matter of, in a way, giving yourself over to what calls your heart continuously, establishing more continuity of that giving over to, rather than the, you know, giving over to the conventional, stressed, driven, pleasure-seeking, you know, resentful, worrying mind, right? And that's a lot how it shows up for me. In this moment, am I giving myself over to fill in the blank, you know, letting go, love, God, whatever it might be that's real for you, that you're seeking to become both emptied out to and lived by, down to earth. Like giving over to continuity of presence, or cultivating the factors that support continuity of present moment awareness, right? Or giving over to lovingness rather than resentfulness. What are you giving yourself over to? Are you giving yourself over to like feeling already full? Wow, there's so much gratitude, so much enoughness. So I don't really have to be driven to get more and more and more, right? It kind of, to me, that's what it really is, in a way. It's like, that's it. Yeah. Yeah, and so I think I maybe as we wrap here, I've offered a few kind of key headlines of, I think, Buddha-ing. Presence, right? Non-clinging, and warmth, love. Any one of those is good. And maybe there's another one or a specific aspect of the three I've mentioned that you can feel, wow, you know, that's the one right now. That would be so good, you know. That's the fire to fuel in my heart. Or I think about a plane landing in a stormy darkness. What's your carrier beam, you know, that's calling you home to a safe landing? These days. How about we sit for a minute? If I may, a word that's very there for me is respect. Why is that? You know, it's like respecting what feeds you. Respect, you know, having respect for it, not in this distanced sense, but in a sense of appreciating it, giving yourself over to, you know, what you respect, and want to become increasingly filled by and lived by and carried by. Not stressing and struggling to find it over there, but letting your own respectfulness naturally marry you to what you're growing in your own heart. Thank you. Okay, good night.